Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, time for a Vault episode. Today, it's part two of our series on fingernails. This episode originally aired on September 3rd, 2020. I think it'll be a scream.
Let's dig right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our talk about nails, fingernails, toenails. In the last episode, we talked about how fast nails grow, what influences how fast they grow, some strange decades-long self-experimentation projects on the measurement of nails. And this time, we're going to get out of some of that scientific minutia and jump into the weirder world of nails and the role that nails and hair play in a lot of very, very surprising and interesting magical and religious beliefs.
Yeah. And it makes sense that we would, since the nails that we look down at every day, we, you know, find ourselves absent-mindedly feeling, that in fact enhance our ability to engage physically with the world. They are strange to behold. Like we said before, they're both alive and dead at the same time, at least as, you know, in the way that we think of them. You know, they're obviously a part of our body, and yet they feel slightly external. You know, there are these things that are like claws, but not claws. So it makes sense that we would have some kind of complicated magical ideas at times about what they are and what they do.
Yeah, and I think some of the magical and religious ideas are going to connect with something that we talked about in the last episode, which was this strange thing I was observing about how our hard body parts, the hard external parts like teeth and nails, though you would expect them to be sort of like the most, I don't know what you would call it, like the most brutally disposable parts of our bodies because they're hard, you know, they're like what you put out front in defense or attack. But in fact, we've got these kind of vulnerability trauma obsessions with these parts of our bodies. Like if you just start worrying about what could go wrong with your body, how you could be injured, how it could be damaged, a lot of the natural places that people go to worry about these things are teeth and nails.
Absolutely. And that's why towards the end of the last episode, we started talking a little bit about Glenn Danzig's fingernails and about how, at least in some music videos or posters that I kind of half remember from my teenage years, I recall that he had sharpened fingernails. And I would wonder to myself, well, what purpose do those have? And indeed, you know, would sharpened fingernails aid you in fights or something? Because I also remember like Stephen King novels and short stories that I also was reading at the time. You'd occasionally have a character show up that has sharpened their teeth down to file points, or perhaps even has some sort of like sharpened fingernails, I guess. And it brings me to wonder, like, would there be any kind of actual combat or defensive advantage to that sort of thing? And we mostly decided that there would not really be. Yes, you can scratch your way out of a scrape here and there, but there's also a big possibility that you'll damage your fingernails if you're trying to use like sharpened fingernails to attack somebody. More than likely, if you encounter somebody with really gnarly looking fingernails that have been sharpened to a point, or indeed just look seemingly intentionally creepy, they probably are trying to look at least a little bit like Nosferatu.
Right. And so this vampire association with long nails, in fact, we were just talking about this with Seth the other day, Seth was sharing with us the idea that, you know, it's possible that the association between long fingernails and vampires could come from the idea that often in the old days, you might open up if you've exhumed a body from the graveyard and you notice that their nails look a little bit long. And so you think, wait a minute, are they still alive in some way? Are they getting up and roaming around and still growing body tissues?
Yeah, I feel like this has come up on the show in the past before, and it certainly... It goes beyond the world of mere vampires. We talked about it a bit in the episode where we talked about the kappa, the Japanese water demon, mm-hmm. Where you have varying monstrous conceptions in the human imagination that are based upon an analysis of physical death to see what happens to the body after it dies and the seeming changes that take place in the body. And in the case of the vampire, yeah, it's like the bloated form, the impression at least that the hair is still growing, the impression that the nails are still growing.
So if you ask the question, is that true? The answer is no. It is not true that hair and fingernails continue to grow after death, at least not to any significant degree. Now, if the nails and the hair don't keep growing after death, that does leave the question of why so many people thought that was the case. Why would you look at a corpse and think that its nails appear long? And the most common explanation for this tends to be based on the dehydration of the corpse, that as the body begins to decompose, it loses a lot of moisture, which causes the retraction of the skin tissues around the fingernails and around the nail plate, which makes the nail plates look longer because there's just less skin around them.
Now, this helps inform more than just our idea of vampires. For starters, it also is factored into the buried alive panics that have existed at different times. I believe we discussed this a bit in an episode of Invention on various casket innovations.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea is, you end up digging up this corpse later. Maybe you don't assume that they were some sort of undead fiend, but you might think, oh, my goodness, they were still alive for some time after we buried them. They must have been buried alive.
And this led to a fashionable demand in the 19th century for caskets with escape hatches and ways of getting out if you happen to have been buried alive.
Yes. So if you want to catch up on that, do check out that episode of Invention. It may still be in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind feed from when we put a bunch of those out earlier in the year. But if not, you can find the dedicated feed to Invention. Even though we're not putting out new episodes of that show in that feed, you'll still find all of those episodes there for your listening.
I think it was a three-parter last October.
Yeah, that's what it was. Now, in addition to this, you'll also find various myths and legends concern just general monstrosity in the world. And oftentimes you'll have a monster that has long fingernails. And this is roughly, associated with the idea that, okay, long fingernails imply a wildness, a kind of bestial nature of the entity or the being in question.
Right. What has claws? Wild animals.
Yeah. And the longer fingernails become, the more like the claws of an animal they become. Now, there are exceptions to this. Long fingernails are sometimes considered fashionable for females. We see a lot of that in modern culture. But then also you sometimes see it as a fashion for males as well. Long nails, for example, were important symbols of social status at various points in Chinese history. And they were sometimes painted for visual effect, but also sometimes the painting or sometimes a lacquering of the nail was as much about strengthening the nail as it was about making it look fancy, which is an interesting point. And apparently this we see echoes of this in other cultures as well. I think the ancient Egyptians are thought to have engaged in this sort of thing as well, strengthening the nail in order to maintain its elongated structure. Now, later on in Chinese history, ornate fingernail guards were used to protect outer nails. So this might be like on the pinky finger, for example, and the ring finger. And we're talking some pretty ornate finger coverings here. For instance, the 6-inch long golden nail protectors that were worn by the Empress Dowager Su Shi, who ruled China for 43 years from 1861 until her death in 1908. If you look her up, you can find actual photographs of her decked out with these things.
Now, Robert, can you describe, is this more of like a thimble-type covering that would go over the end of the finger and extend out from there, or is it more like that finger armor stuff that has joints and goes over the whole finger?
Not really joints, per se. One gets the impression of like long, tapering, golden fingertip covers. I think this sort of thing has also been utilized in dance in various Asian cultures.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they're really neat looking. Now, in terms of just longer fingernails in general, the style has also been popular with males at different times in Chinese history, with longer manicured nails still having a residual cultural association with higher classes in society. One also sees the retention of a long pinky fingernail as a signifier of social status, but then there are also varying levels of when you get into to the actual reasons that individuals self-identify and certainly explain their pinky nail. They might be, well, it's for good luck, or you know, it might be there might be some idea of divinational aspects of finger morphology. There are various sort of cultural ideas that seem to be floating around explaining, you know, why one would have a longer nail.
If there's a class association that nails are, you know, for higher social status, I wonder if it has anything to do with demonstrating the lack of need to engage in physical or manual labor.
Yes.
Sort of along the same lines as, you know, there are some cultures, I think it was once common in European culture, and it was fashionable for men to wear like long pointy shoes. And one explanation given for this is, well, a long pointy shoe makes you look rich because it's a kind of shoe that you can't do any physical work in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. The best explanations seem to tie it to this like longstanding idea that it informs social status. However, I should note that I've looked into this a couple of times over the years, and I've never found like not to say it doesn't exist, but I've never found like a really good paper on this that really dives in with a lot of the information out there about this is more informal in nature. Mm-hmm. But traditional Chinese cultural hierarchies do seem to retain their power. Though, according to one paper I was looking at, Saving Face in China, Modernization, Parental Pressure, and Plastic Surgery by Andrew Lindridge and Chufeng Wang, published in the Journal of Consumer Affairs in 2008. So, you know, basically underlying the idea that you can have these ideas that are still floating around in society, and perhaps, you know, perhaps the rationale for them isn't, you know, 100% in an individual's forethought, but it's just something that survives and is still done, and perhaps on some level still does inform that notion that I have this longer nail, which means I am of a higher social status and maybe don't have to engage in as much physical labor. For an historical example of this, getting outside of modern culture, there's a book that I've been fond of for many years titled Tales from a Chinese Studio. And it's a collection from 1740 of these various weird tales that were compiled by the author Pu Songling. And it's these are wonderful stories. I recommend anyone who's even halfway interested in strange Chinese ghost stories, you should pick up a copy of this because some of them are funny. Some of them are just really weird. There's also a certain poetry to them. And I understand that if one is actually reading these stories in Mandarin, there are also a lot of various allusions that are going to be lost on the English language translation reader. But they're still tremendous as translated pieces.
I think you've quoted from it before. I have positive associations with this title.
Yeah, it's a great book, and I think Penguin has an edition of it. So I was looking back through that because I'm thinking, okay, if there's a good example of a monster with long fingernails, perhaps I'll find it in Tales from a Chinese Studio. I did not find it, but I did find this little note about a particular line in one of his writings that I had skipped over before, or I didn't remember from before. Pu Songling mentions the Bard of the Long Nails,
ooh,
which the translators and editors of this Penguin edition identify as Li He, who lived 760 through 816. So he was a late Tang scholar, often characterized as a sort of, quote, doomed poet with a vision so intense the world will destroy him if he does not destroy himself.
Whoa.
And so the editors here, they compared him to John Keats.
That's interesting because Keats definitely died young, but I don't really think of him as doom-driven in that way. When I think of doom-driven English poets, I guess I would think more like Byron or Percy Shelley.
Yeah, Lord Byron definitely comes to mind, right? Especially with when it comes to like a dark bad boy status, walking around right. with a skull goblet and a pet bear on a chain.
Exactly.
And interestingly enough, if you look up some of Li He's translated work, he is sometimes described as, this is from the Amazon description to a nice collection of his work, the bad boy poet of the late Tang Dynasty.
Well, then I got to hear more from this bad boy.
Okay.
So was the fact that he was a bad boy at all related to the perception of him having long nails?
Well, yes and no, I think. I think this will maybe become a little more clear. Like, for instance, I don't think the fact that he had long nails was like the signifying bad boy aspect about him. I take that to be probably more in common with professional scholars of the day. Like, you know, you're a scholar, you're a man of words. You certainly don't need short nails in order to engage in a bunch of physical labor. Like, you're a man of letters.
I see.
That being said, he has a very gothic quality to him. The New Tang History of 1060 described him as, quote, frail and thin, with eyebrows that met together and long fingernails. He was also known as the demon talent due to his love of weird and exotic subjects in his writings. And the New Tang History also said that he, quote, felt himself already halfway across the boundary between the living and the dead. Now, that being said, apparently he also wrote about mundane topics as well, like, you know, earth, you know, like food and so forth. So it wasn't just all ghoulish content.
Maybe a spooky food?
Yeah. Oh, no, I think he generally, you know, wrote about food in an acceptable, you know, non, what we would think of in Western terms as a, you know, a non-gothic sense. Anyway, if you look up his work, it is really quite beautiful. He is apparently most famous for this poem, Song of Magic Strings, that the editors and translators of the Pu Songling text include. The poem itself was translated by John Fordsham in 1983's Goddesses, Ghosts, and Demons, the collected poems of Li He, which you can buy in like a ebook or physical form. I'm thinking of picking up a copy. But here's just a little bit from that poem. Quote, blue raccoons are weeping blood as shivering foxes die. On the ancient wall, a painted dragon, tail inlaid with gold, the rain god is riding it away to an autumn tarn. Owls that have lived 100 years, turned forest demons, laugh wildly as an emerald fire leaps from their nests.
Wow. That is electrifying, yeah. Man. I've got goosebumps.
Yeah, yeah. Like I say, I think I'm going to pick up a copy for this Halloween season. There was another line when I was looking at the preview of that actual text. Fordsham wrote, quote, Li He was temperamentally unable to write a conventional social poem, and consequently, he is very rarely dull. So apparently to be like a professional man of words, to be like, you know, a writer of the day, you had to engage in a lot of sort of boring, sort of courtly writing. The example that he gave was, it was apparently common to sort of to write to patrons and compliment them on, say, the birth of a child. And there's an example of this short poetic piece that he wrote to such a patron. And he makes it sound like Fordstrom compares it to the child from The Omen, about just how he describes this child as like being able to like see through people to their soul or something to that effect. It's pretty interesting. So I like the idea of this bard of the long nails who, when he tries to fit in and be like just a boring poet, he can't quite do it. He's just a little too weird. But I should drive home that I don't think the long nails were the weird thing about him.
No, it was that he would write you a note saying, "Congratulations on the birth of your child who will one day flay my soul in the underworld."
Yeah, that sort of thing. So anyway, I encourage everyone to check out both of those authors. But anyway, back to nails in general. Long nails have apparently sometimes been seen as a luxury for those of upper classes in various cultures who don't have to truly labor with their hands. And I've eyed a couple of studies, at least, that back this up, such as excessively long fingernails as a risk factor for upper extremity soft tissue injury, published in 2008 in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine. And another paper, Effects of Fingernail Length on Finger and Hand Performance, published in the journal Hand Therapy back in 2000. And this second paper here recommends keeping fingernails shortened to at least 0.5 centimeters to, quote, achieve optimal functional outcomes.
Oh, well, I guess, to be fair, I laughed because I was imagining optimal functional outcomes of hands just in regular life. But I guess this is talking about therapy. So that phrasing makes sense.
Yes. This paper does seem to be narrowing its focus somewhat. And I think it's also worth noting that, for my own part, I've encountered people with very long, well-maintained nails, sometimes very fancy looking nails that seem quite capable of manipulating their environment in, say, an office setting. Though perhaps that's not that different from the sort of physical demands of a scholar in China of old. You're still not having to like actually physically dig in the earth or something to that effect. So I'm not sure. I'd be interested to hear from anyone out there who does who has had long nails in the past or keeps and maintains long nails today. Like, are there things that you find that they get in the way of, or are they just generally not in the way? Do you sort of adapt? I mean, obviously, we can adapt our body schema to accommodate for any number of extra things. It seems like just longer nails, I mean, that's even more a part of our body than any tool or costume that we might acquire.
All right, it's time to take a quick break, but when we come back, we can talk about a demon warship made out of nails.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back, and I'm excited for this, Joe, because you were about to embark on a journey, and you're going to tell us about what may be the magical fingernail story par excellence.
I mean, there are a lot of great magical fingernail stories that I'm about to get into, but this might be the most thoroughly mythological one, the one that's like the most like a device in a story where the nails are sort of the MacGuffin. Though there's also a very good Persian one that we'll get into. But anyway, so I want to go to the Prose Edda. This is a work that tells us a lot of what we know about ancient Norse mythology that was written or edited by the medieval Icelandic author Snorri Sturluson. In the Prose Edda, there are these collected literary works that tell many of the stories of Norse mythology, including the story of Ragnarok, the final confrontation, the destruction of the gods at the end of that era. And but early on, there's a passage in the Prose Edda that's just talking about ships, just mentioning what kinds of mythological ships there are. And it mentions one ship in passing, calling it the Naglfar. And it only says a couple of things about the Naglfar. It says that it is in Muspel. Muspel is a realm of fire, the home of the fire giants, who you don't want to mess with. And the passage also mentions that Naglfar is the largest, meaning the largest of all ships. So what is this Naglfar, the largest of all ships? Well, later the author here tells us that the Naglfar will appear over the horizon during the calamity of Ragnarok, when the gods will be destroyed. And the author also tells us something about its construction, and here I'm going to quote directly from the work. Quote, "The stars shall be hurled from heaven. Then it shall come to pass that the earth and the mountains will shake so violently that trees will be torn up by the roots, and the mountains will topple down, and all bonds and fetters will be broken and snapped. The Fenris wolf gets loose. The sea rushes over the earth, for the Midgard serpent writhes in giant rage and seeks to gain the land. The ship that is called Naglfar also becomes loose. It is made of the nails of dead men. Wherefore it is worth warning that, when a man dies with unpaired nails, he supplies a large amount of materials for the building of this ship, which both gods and men wish may be finished as late as possible. But in this flood, Naglfar gets afloat. The giant Hrym is its steersman." Or that might be Hrym, H-R-Y-M. But okay, yeah, so it's got giants on it. It's got the giant Hrym or Hrym as its steersman, and it's made out of the fingernails and toenails of dead men who did not care appropriately for their nails at the time of death.
That is gnarly. I'm not surprised at all to learn as well that there is a longstanding Swedish black metal band that has Naglfar as its name. They've been active since the early 90s, apparently.
Oh, wow. I'd never heard of them. But of course, yeah, I mean, in anything this gnarly is going to end up as a metal band name. But I should also mention that in telling the same story, the story of Ragnarok, you know, sort of the destruction of the gods at the end of at the end of time, or maybe not of time, at least at the end of the era, the age of the gods. It is the same scene is described in the Völuspá, which is an old Norse poem describing a lot of mythological events that we've mentioned on the show pretty recently, actually. Wait, which episode did it come up in? I cannot recall the context at the moment, but there's also a quatrain in the Völuspá that mentions it. It says, "From the east comes Hrym with shield held high. In giant wrath does the serpent writhe. O'er the waves he twists, and the tawny eagle gnaws corpses, screaming, Naglfar is loose."
I love the idea that it's, I don't know, this is just me reading into it perhaps, but it feels like it's not just the bones it's not bones that are making up the ship. It is the toenails and the fingernails that seem more like the detritus of the dead body. You know, it seems like this is like a ship that has been collecting and assembling, like at the bottom of the universe, throughout all of human conflict. You know, and so that's why it is only completely finished towards the very end of human existence.
So there's a paper I want to talk about, Robert, if you're ready, called The Treatment of Hair and Fingernails Among the Indo-Europeans.
Oh, yes. I am ready for this because I've read about certainly nothing on the ship level, the shipbuilding level, but I've read about some of these folk beliefs before.
Yeah. So this is a paper by Bruce Lincoln, who is a scholar of religious studies at the University of Chicago. It was published in 1977, and that's worth noting. This is an older paper. I'm citing it because it's still really interesting, but I just want to flag that it's older because it's possible that in the intervening years, some of Lincoln's factual assumptions might have been superseded by more recent anthropological or historical research. But I think the general thrust of the question he poses remains, and some of the hypotheses he discusses in this article remain extremely interesting. Okay, so he starts like this, quote, "One of the important lessons that is learned from the study of history of religions is that there is no act so small or insignificant that it cannot take on symbolic importance in certain cultures. It is not always an easy task to recognize such symbolically invested action, although the existence of elaborate rules for behavior in a given situation may serve as a valuable clue. And if the identification of such action is sometimes difficult, the interpretation of a given motion, gesture, or ritual is even more delicate." And the example that he gives that he's going to talk about in this paper is the extremely careful, meticulous rules governing the treatment of clippings from the hair and nails in many cultures and religions throughout the world, especially in many cultures that are descended from, in some way, the ancient speakers of Proto-Indo-European, which I'll get into more later. So I'm going to start by just listing a number of examples that Lincoln brings up, and then we can go back and talk about possible explanations for where these beliefs and religious practices come from. So the first one mentioned by Lincoln concerns the hair specifically, and it's the rite of the child's first haircut or first tonsure, practiced historically by some people of India, and it's described in the Sankhayana Griha Sutra. And the Griha Sutras are a number of manuals describing the steps of various domestic religious ceremonies. So I think specifically the kind of religious ceremonies that you might perform around the house.
Okay.
So this is performed for different children at different ages, I think also traditionally depending on caste. But the process goes like this in Lincoln's summary. Quote, "The child's hair is untangled and anointed, and a young kusa shoot is placed in it, kusa being the sacred grass of ceremonial. His hair is then shaved with a copper razor and placed on a mound of bull dung mixed with kusa grass that has been prepared to receive the hair. Finally," and here he quotes directly from a translation of the Sankhayana Griha Sutra, quote, "To the northeast, in a place covered with herbs, or in the neighborhood of water, they bury the hairs in the earth." So that's interesting to begin with. You have this ritual of, at a certain age, the child's hair is shaved or cut, and then it is in a kind of symbolic ritual way planted within dung or within the earth. And there's this association with vegetation or herbs.
Interesting. Now, this may have absolutely no connection with it, but a while back, I guess, oh man, probably about a year ago, my son and I had our hair cut at our house on our front porch. And afterwards, the individual who cut our hair encouraged us to take the clippings and put at least some of them in our garden in order to help deter creatures from eating our vegetables.
Hmm. I wonder if that actually works.
I don't know, but I've heard also similar advice concerning a little like hair from your pet, like to keep rodents out of your garden, to put some hair from your cat, for instance, in there. Which I mean, it sounds like it could work. I don't know that I've seen anything to actually back that up, except I haven't noticed any mice or rats out there. But then again, just because you don't notice them doesn't mean they're not there.
Yeah, that's interesting. We'll definitely keep that in mind as we go through a few more of these examples. So the next one that Lincoln cites comes from ancient Roman religion. And this is the example of the Flamen Dialis, or the high priest of Jupiter, the chief god of the Roman pantheon. And the Flamen Dialis had numerous ceremonial requirements and restrictions guiding his daily activities. There were rules about where he had to sleep. There were rules about what he was supposed to wear, about what kinds of things he could touch or couldn't touch. And one of these restrictions, as reported by the 2nd century Roman author Aulus Gellius in a text called Attic Nights, goes like this, and this is with some abridgments, quote, "The ceremonies placed upon the Flamen Dialis are many, and the forbearances are numerous. No one should cut the hair of the Dialis except a free man. The cuttings of the nails and hair of the Dialis are buried in the earth under a fruitful tree. There are almost the same ceremonies for the Flaminica Dialis," and I think that's the wife of the high priest of Jupiter, "and they say that other different ones are to be observed, for instance, that she is covered with a dyed gown, and that in her veil she has the shoot of a fruitful tree."
Hmm.
And there are other similar practices elsewhere in ancient Roman religion. For example, in the Natural History, Pliny the Elder recounts how the Vestal Virgins are expected to observe special ceremonies in the disposal of the trimmings from their hair. Pliny writes, quote, "Truly, there is a lotus tree in Rome, in the area of Lucina. Now, this tree is about 500 years old or older. Its age is uncertain, and it is called the Hairy One, because the hair of the Vestal Virgins is brought to it." So note again the kind of rough similarities with the Indian practice here, the association with vegetation especially.
Well, hair is a thing that grows out of us, not unlike a plant, right? Or some sort of vine. And then I guess a lot of this, too, just has to do with the fact that hair and fingernails and toenails as well are these things that are paradoxically a part of us and yet not a part of us. And then when we trim them away or cut them away, they are no longer part of our bodies, that they came from our bodies. And therefore, you could see where you could easily lean into this idea that something appropriate must be done with these parts of ourselves.
Yeah, and we'll get into more about that in the part where we talk about the possible explanations for these. But I want to talk about the next example Lincoln cites, which is German folkloric practices. He writes that there are a number of archaic rituals among people speaking Germanic languages for dealing with the disposal of clippings from the hair and nails. Quote, "Thus in Oldenburg, hair and nails are wrapped in a cloth and fastened under a tree 3 days before the new moon to cure infertility. Similarly, in Brandenburg, Dusseldorf, Swabia, and elsewhere, hair and nails are placed in a hole bored in a tree or are placed on a branch. This is often done when one suffers from some sort of pain, and the pain is said to go with these, moving to anyone who comes close to them." Now, there are some differences here from the other examples we already talked about because, Lincoln points out it's important to note that these practices he just mentioned are targeted towards specific magical outcomes like the curing of infertility or the healing of pain rather than a sort of free-floating ritual without a specific outcome object. But he notes, again, the similarity in the association between hair and nails with plant life. Again, hair and nails, and then trees and grass and branches. And then finally, one more example, and this one is probably my favorite one. He draws attention to what is described in an ancient text in the Avestan language, which is associated with the ancient Iranian culture and is a foundational religious text of Zoroastrianism. So this text is known as the Vindidad or the Vidivdat. And in this writing, the character of Zoroaster, also known as Zarathustra, and I think Zarathustra is probably the earlier pronunciation, Zarathustra is speaking to the wise lord, Ahura Mazda, and Zarathustra asks the wise lord why it is that the demon named Aosha, whose name literally means burning or destruction, why Aosha harms and punishes humans, and Ahura Mazda explains as follows, quote, "Truly that, righteous Zarathustra, when one arranges and cuts his hair and clips his nails and then lets them fall into holes in the earth or into furrows, for by these improprieties, demons come forth, and from these improprieties, monsters come forth from the earth, which mortals call lice, and which devour the grain in the fields and the clothes in the closets. Now, when you must arrange and cut your hair and clip your nails in the world, Zarathustra, hereafter you should bear it 10 steps from righteous men, 20 steps from fire, 30 steps from water, and 50 steps from the Burisman, which is a bundle of sacred twigs. When it is laid out, then you should dig a pit here, a disti deep in hard soil, and a vitasti deep in soft soil. To that pit you should bear the cuttings. Then you should pronounce these words, victorious Zarathustra. Now for me may Mazda make the plants grow by means of Asha, and Asha means right. You should plow 3 or 6 or 9 furrows for Zasora Vaira, meaning good dominion, and you should recite the Ahuna Vaira prayer 3 or 6 or 9 times. So here in this ancient Zoroastrian text, you're getting this elaborate ritual described for what you should do with the trimmings from your hair and nails, and that there are actual, like, real demonic consequences if you do not follow these rituals. And Lincoln points out several things he finds really interesting about the explanation from the wise lord to Zarathustra. So first of all, there's the need to carry these clippings from hair and nails away from sources of purification. Remember the mentions of you got to carry them this far away from righteous men, this far away from fire, from water, and from the sacred bundle of twigs, because these are all potentially sources of religious purity, and it seems like there's a desire to avoid cross-contamination of all that purifying matter with impure matter that you've just trimmed off of your body. But then there's also, Lincoln points out, the use of troughs to demarcate a sacred space, and then also the spontaneous production of monsters from the hair and nail trimmings that are disposed of incorrectly. And if that sounds familiar based on stuff we were just talking about, isn't that kind of similar to the supposed origin of the Naglfar, the nail ship? So in the Ragnarok myth, again, from Norse religion, this ship is built out of the nails of dead men as a result of their nails not being trimmed and disposed of properly according to the correct rituals. So if you do the wrong thing with your nails, you make an accidental donation to the construction of the demon's galleon.
Oh, wow. So this is fascinating, because on one hand, you can compare a lot of this with just kind of a basic understanding that this is bio waste. And there is an appropriate and an inappropriate way to dispose of bio waste. But then, of course, we have this whole magical domain as well of monsters and monstrous ships rising up from sort of the accretion of these materials.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Lincoln doesn't really get into this at all, but it's interesting to wonder about what role practical biological facts could play into the origins of these practices. I don't know if there is, for example, any kind of real disease risk that you would get from encountering the trimmings of hair and nails from other people. Perhaps there's some, but it seems like there would be less of that than there would be from, say, contact with blood or feces. though I'm not sure. I mean, it's interesting that there's a mention of lice, and one of the things yes. talking about being disposed of here is hair.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we might think, well, the hair is the place where the lice live, therefore, you know, we're less inclined to pick up odd pieces of hair that we find just out on the road. I mean, certainly, I think we can all mm-hmm. attest to, you know, being on a walk or something and encountering a piece of someone's hair or, you know, hair clippings or perhaps even a fingernail or a toenail. And your first instinct is not to pick that material up and look closer.
Yeah, put it in your mouth. Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't seem like a natural thing to do.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back.
But we've been talking about all these examples from all over, you know, different parts of the world of religious or magical significance that is granted to trimmings from the hair and nails. And this list is far from exhaustive. There are tons of examples in practices all over the place. But I think just the examples we've talked about do help paint a picture of the wide range of myths, beliefs, and practices about hair and nails and the many similarities between them. But the question is, why? Why do so many different cultures place this important ritual or religious significance on the correct procedures for trimming and disposing of hair and nails? Now, Lincoln, in his paper, goes over several possible answers to this question that had been advanced by the time he was writing in the 70s. And I would say this list of possible explanations is also not going to be exhaustive, but just to discuss a few possibilities. One is a very influential theory that's best known for its articulation by the late 19th and early 20th century Scottish anthropologist J.G. Fraser in The Golden Bough. The Golden Bough has come up on the show before. Fraser, of course, is enormously influential, but also heavily criticized. We can talk about that in a minute. But Fraser argues that many of these practices have their roots in a widespread ancient belief in what he would have called the contagious branch of sympathetic magic. So the basic idea here is that if something was once touching your body, or especially if it was part of your body, that matter, that object, maintains a magical connection to your body even after being physically separated from it. And thus, it could be used by a witch or a sorcerer to work curses on you or magically control you in some way. So if Jimmy the sorcerer gets hold of your hair or nail trimmings, you are in for a very bad time. And so in order to protect yourself from this kind of sympathetic magic, you either had to destroy your hair and nail trimmings or hide them very well, or maybe also perform some kind of purging ritual to rid this matter of its contagious magical power. And I think it's interesting we still see evidence of this kind of magical thinking even today. I mean, there is magical thinking that persists into the modern era, whereby you can have some kind of power over a person by possessing a personal artifact of theirs or an object that touched their body. You know, think about like doing magic on someone by possessing their hairbrush.
Right. There's also some interesting stuff about just how we think about the contamination of objects. There's this study back in the 1990s by social psychologist Paul Rosen, and this was actually recently mentioned on an episode of the excellent radio show Hidden Brain. They pointed out that they asked, in this particular study, they asked people if they would consider wearing Hitler's sweater. And they almost always said no. And they said no, even if they'd been assured that it had been washed, that it had been torn, you know, that it had been punished for being Hitler's sweater, or that it had been symbolically cleansed by being worn by, say, Mother Teresa before being passed on. And it was this idea that this object, this sweater, is contaminated in a way that cannot be punished away, cannot be cleansed away. It just remains impure in a completely irrational manner.
That is really funny. I mean, I can just say for myself, like I rationally do not believe in any kind of sympathetic contagious magic. So I don't think like Hitler's evil would be contained in the physical sweater in any way, but still I wouldn't want to put it on.
Well, yeah, I have a lot of nitpicky questions about that scenario. Like, is it a good sweater? Like, is there anything notable about the sweater other than it was Hitler's sweater? Because obviously I'm not going to just wear a sweater because Hitler wore it. But what if I like was at a store and there was like vintage stuff and there was like this really nice sweater. And I'm like, oh, this is nice. And then I ask, why is it so cheap? And they tell me, oh, because this was Hitler's sweater. Then, okay, that might be different because I have some pre-existing interest in it. There's something about that sweater that's really neat. I don't necessarily get that from this limited scenario. You know, it's kind of implied that the notable thing about the sweater is that it was Hitler's.
Well, you know, I actually can think of a reason I wouldn't want to wear that sweater or own it, even though I don't believe in any magical associations, which is that, I mean, I guess if you were to wear a sweater that you knew had been worn by Hitler, you'd probably end up thinking about Hitler all the time. And, you know, it's like every time you put it on, you have to be like, oh, yeah, Hitler. And you just don't want Hitler in your brain that much.
Yeah. I mean, to a certain extent, one encounters this with the you know, the struggle to separate, say, an artist from the art, that can sort of be the Hitler's sweater scenario in some cases where you're like, okay, there's nothing wrong with the sweater, but I can't wear it without thinking about Hitler. So I just don't think I'm going to wear this anymore.
So it's worth noting that Fraser's work on the origins of religions, again, as I said earlier, was both enormously influential and has come under a lot of criticism. you know, I'm not deep on this, but I think one common criticism is that Fraser would sometimes, I think, kind of fudge or cherry pick the ethnographic evidence he cited in order to make things fit more cleanly into his broader theories. And, you know, this is something I think that a lot of writers who have grand theories about human culture and society end up being guilty of. So while The Golden Bough remains a fascinating read, I would advocate that you shouldn't rely on Fraser alone as your sole source for anything. And in Lincoln's analysis of Fraser's thoughts on the origins of these rituals for dealing with hair and nails in sympathetic contagious magic, Lincoln thinks that, well, probably a lot of practices do have some kind of roots like that, but he's not convinced that contagious sympathetic magic lies at the root of all of these practices, and certainly not the practices in the cultures that that have some origins in the speakers of Proto-Indo-European, because he has a different theory about that that we can get into in just a minute. Lincoln also mentions the work of an anthropologist named Mary Douglas, who is a very influential 20th century anthropologist. She proposed that that within human religious thinking, quote, that the body is a powerful model or image which can represent any bounded system, and which most often represents society itself. The limits of the body, then, represent the limits of society, the points at which it encounters opposition and danger, and must thus be treated with appropriate care. So she's arguing, basically, that we symbolically make an equivalence between our bodies and the society at large, and that margins in general are dangerous and ambiguous places, and thus the things that come off of our body represent ambiguity at the margins in the larger context of symbolic thinking about the society, so you have to carefully regulate this marginal body matter. And Lincoln in this paper, he similarly thinks this idea is interesting, that it might explain some things, but he's got a different theory that is based in the Proto-Indo-European creation myth. So the Proto-Indo-Europeans are a hypothesized prehistoric culture that we know about primarily through reconstruction of their language, which is a direct ancestor to a huge number of historical and existing languages throughout Asia and Europe. Just for example, English has a number of roots in different languages, including but not limited to Germanic languages and Romance languages, but both Germanic and Romance languages themselves have roots in Proto-Indo-European language. So, you know, there was a root language that influenced these derivative languages that developed in, you know, different ways, and then those derivative languages came back and in a way combined to influence other languages like English. The Proto-Indo-European people left no written records, but linguists have been able to reconstruct a lot of their language by tracing back similar word roots in a widespread catalog of languages. Similarly, scholars have tried to reconstruct other things about them. We don't know a lot of things for sure, but they probably lived somewhere around southern Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan, sort of between and to the north of the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, probably a few thousand years BCE. We don't have any direct records of their religious beliefs, their myths, and their practices, but scholars, including Bruce Lincoln, have used clues from other descendant religions to try as best as possible to reconstruct elements such as their creation myth. And Lincoln explains his hypothetical reconstruction of this creation myth as follows, quote, "This myth, as I have established elsewhere, told how the world and all the creatures in it were established by the first act of sacrifice. In the primordial offering, the first priest, Manu, meaning man, dismembered the first king, Yemo, meaning twin, and from his body built up the material world. Now, certain steps in the process of creation were described in this myth, steps whereby the body of the primordial victim became the world. Thus, his skull became the heavens, his eyes the sun and moon, his blood the seas, and, what is most important for the issue at hand, his hair became the plants and trees."
Oh, this is a great point.
And so Lincoln quotes, he goes on to quote a bunch of related ancient religious texts that serve as evidence for his reconstruction of the myth in this way. And of course, we don't know that this is actually what their creation myth was like, but it seems like a reasonable approximation of what their creation myth might have been like, given what we know from a lot of other religions that seem related to it. And this is, of course, I mean, you can immediately think of other examples of creation myths in which the parts of the world are made out of the body of a slain primordial foe. Think about the ways that in, say, the Enuma Elish, that the body of Tiamat, the dragon, you know, the sea monster, gets turned into the, you know, the mountains and the sky and the seas and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, this is something you do see in a number of different mythologies. Like the, if nothing else, you could even summarize just to say that the body, the primordial body of beings such as this are important in the way that they are then taken apart and then redistributed, and those parts become important aspects of the world that follows.
Right. And so Lincoln says that, you know, if his reconstruction of the Proto-Indo-European creation myth is basically correct, is or is on the right track, that a lot of religious practices around disposal of hair and nails in cultures that are in part descended from the Proto-Indo-Europeans could be rooted in a recapitulation of this creation myth. And this draws on a strain of thinking that I think in some way is associated with Eliade, for example, that a lot of religious rituals are in a way supposed to be a reenactment of a foundational myth.
Yeah, yeah. The idea that everything we do is only important in the archaic sense if we are recreating something from our founding myths.
Right. So that's ultimately Lincoln's theory here, what he thinks best explains the widespread nature of these practices about the disposal of hair and nails, that he thinks when you dispose of hair and nail clippings in the correct way, you are furthering the life of the world's vegetation in keeping with the creation story. The sacrifice here is your own body, and the sacrifice of hair, originally he thinks hair, and the nails were sort of added on to the hair sacrifice, feeds the trees and the grasses the same way that this primordially slain foe originally created all that vegetation. And then Lincoln says the other half of the coin is, quote, when such care is not taken, when disposal is not a ritual and does not repeat the acts of a mythic model, the reverse can be the effect. For if proper disposal serves to create the cosmos, then improper disposal can decreate it, or, to put it negatively, can serve to create chaos out of cosmos. And think of the examples, again, we discussed here, the destruction of crops by lice demons from the Avestan text, you know, the ancient Zoroastrian text, or the creation of the Naglfar, the ship that brings monsters to deliver the violent end of the world, and the destruction of the gods that's made out of the nails of dead men improperly cared for. So obviously, I mean, I would say in my final thoughts, obviously Lincoln's idea here about the origins of these practices could be wrong. But at the very least, it provides some really interesting scaffolding for understanding ways in which complex symbolic religious thinking might enter into what we would consider an extremely mundane grooming practice. How it's possible that just clipping your nails and cutting your hair to many people might have cosmic significance because of the myths that informed their worldview.
Yeah, this is all very fascinating. You know, it gets to the sort of the ambiguity of what our nails and our and as well as our hair, like, well, what they really are, and then yeah, what are we supposed to do with them once they leave our body, and then what sort of ideas do we end up building up about those things and our identity and our place in the cosmos?
Yeah, totally. So maybe. Maybe if you're somebody who has a, say, a partner or a roommate or a family member who gets mad when you just like clip your toenails in a willy-nilly fashion, they shoot all over the room and you do not collect them in a clean and tidy way for proper disposal. Think about this interpretation of the Proto-Indo-European creation myth. What if you are somehow creating chaos out of order by doing so, and you are summoning demons up from the earth?
Yeah, yeah, indeed. I think there's probably like a wide variety of different takes on this as well. Like I think I've run across examples of a Chinese superstition that at least exists in some places where you are not supposed to trim your toenails at night while it's dark outside. Or not to trim them outside at night. For my own part, I mean, I prefer to trim my my nails outside if I can. I feel like that just simplifies the whole scenario. You know, you don't have to worry about finding them if they go flying or anything like that. Now, one thing that comes to my mind is, you know, in terms of the parts of our bodies that we leave behind on a regular basis. I mean, humans have it fairly simple, you know, it's just the mostly just the nails and the hair. And yet we still manage to build up all these fabulous ideas to construct demon ships of the mind. Imagine what it would be like if we like molted and left behind an exoskeleton that resembled ourselves, you know, sort of like the cicada shell that is left behind. Or imagine that we did something along the lines of Squid that leave behind us a pseudomorph, you know, a cloud of ink that is in the shape of their body to fool predators, that sort of thing. Imagine what sort of like strange ideas about self and former self such beings, intelligent beings might have.
Yeah. Can you imagine the religion and the religious practices of intelligent arthropods that had to molt and have a whole body shell that was left behind? Oh, man, that would be good. That's something good for your sci-fi novel there.
Yeah. I mean, what shape would it take? Would it be would you have like special burial grounds where all of your various exoskeletons go once you've morphed out of them? Do famous crab people, do their exoskeleton moltings wind up in a museum somewhere? I don't know. There's so many questions to ask. As always, if you've run across any examples in science fiction or fantasy that deal with these sort of issues, we'd love to hear from you. We always love your to hear advice from listeners on old works of science fiction and fantasy, or new works as well. Likewise, we touched on a lot of different traditions and cultures in this episode especially. So I would love to hear from absolutely anybody who has insight on this, particularly with long nails, for example. Do you keep your nails long? Have you ever kept your nails long? Write in. I'd like to know how that has impacted your life or not impacted your life. Likewise, if there's a particular tradition in your culture or your culture of origin, I would like to hear about that as well. And certainly, as Joe mentioned, if there are any particular practices that you engage in, either culturally or just sort of as a quirk of your own individual nature regarding your nail and hair trimmings, we would love to hear what they are.
Totally.
In the meantime, if you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you find your podcasts, and wherever that happens to be, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us to answer any of the questions Robert just listed, or if you'd like to suggest a topic for the future, or you've got any other feedback on this episode, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.